This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we start today with the momentous sale of a local paper. The Bay State Banner is one of New England's last newspapers devoted to covering Black residents and other communities of color in Greater Boston. Melvin Miller, known as Mel, founded it nearly 60 years ago. Now, local news sources have been in crisis for more than two decades, according to research out of the University of North Carolina. So it was particularly striking when news broke that Miller was selling the paper to a new generation of Black journalists, Andre Stark and Ronald Mitchell, giving the paper a shot at maybe another half century of service. Stark and Mitchell are here with us in Studio 2. Both have had full careers in film and journalism. Ronald Mitchell at WBZ and CBS here in Boston. Stark in film and documentary production. Ron, welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome. And Andre, welcome to you too.
Thank you very much.
All right. So do either of you remember the first time you picked up the Bay State Banner, first time you ever saw it or read it?
I remember my parents would always read it religiously.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to know what was going on in the community. They didn't feel that some of the other media outlets treated them fairly. And they always wanted to have it in the house, reading it at one point or another. Plus, they wanted to see how some of their other community members were doing in business, in medicine, and a variety of other industries.
And I think that you have to remember that the Bay State Banner stands on the legacy of other African-American papers going back hundreds of years. You know, I can't remember the first time I had it. It was just always there. It was a mainstay in the house, you know, back along with Jet Magazine and other publications that were, you know, created by us for us. So we would see positive images of ourselves. And the Banner was also one that was very politically astute. You know, you have to have reporters who can tell the truth about what's going on. And there's always that challenge when it comes to journalism in any city.
You know, a few years ago, we had historian Carrie Greenidge on. I mean, we have her on a lot. But a few years ago, we did a book she did on William Monroe Trotter and his paper, The Guardian, right?
Guardian, that's
so
right.
So now, Ron, we're back, what, 120 years there. Do you see the two of you as picking up the mantle of that tradition and carrying it forward for the next half century or however long this next round goes?
Absolutely. We know that there is a thirst for news about the community, and there always has been and there always will be. And many people feel that the Banner treats them fairly rather than some of the other papers in town. And so we know that there's a pressure and an exhilaration from a lot of people who realize that this paper is theirs and they want it carrying the water for them in whichever way possible you can do it.
And culturally, it even goes back further than William Monroe Trotter. If you talk about the African culture in Africa and who are the important members of a tribe, the griot, the storyteller, the historian of that tribe.
The oral historian.
The oral historian is a very, very important member of that tribe because it tells the history of our people going back and, you know, in their culture going back multiple generations. So this is really the African-American extension of that history. And we are just stepping, you know, standing on the shoulders of many other African-American folks who have, you know, been journalists and who have taken the mantle. You know, when we, Andre and I first went in our first conversation with Mel, he, you know, asked me about if I still owned the farm that my dad grew up on in Canton, because he had hung out there with my dad, my father Michael, and my aunt Jean McGuire. You know, he knew them as teenagers. They were his contemporaries. My grandfather was a minister, and his parents knew my grandparents. So it was, you know, really refreshing when you went in. I didn't realize all that, but he knew that about me. And he also said some things to Andre as well, which were equally as intuitive.
That's right. He knew my aunt from high school, and they went to the prom together, and he said, so I know you, you know, and my cousin Lisa Simmons runs the Roxbury Film Festival, and he goes, I know them, and I feel comfortable talking to you about this legacy and having you carry the mantle forward.
I want to bring his voice in here, and we're speaking with Andre Stark and Ron Mitchell, who are the new co-owners of the Bay State Banner. Back in 2019, Mel Miller, who was the founder again, joined Radio Boston, and he was talking about the founding back in 1965 in the context of the recent passage of the Landmark Civil Rights Act. Here he is.
It was clear to me that now there was a law that pushed most of the discrimination that we had to face beyond the pale of protection. There was an end to discrimination in employment, education, and places of public accommodation. we thought that building on that basis, we should be able to do a lot more.
What's really striking to me about that, Ron Mitchell, is he knew his moment, right? He saw the opportunity. He knew the moment. He seized the moment with a new paper and took it lots of places since then. How do you see this moment as a new co-owner of the Bay State Banner?
Well, I see it as a crucial time in our society. Local newspapers are the last line of defense in telling our community the truth about the important things we need to know to make good choices for ourselves. I really do believe that with the gutting of many local papers and with the misinformation, I call it the brain block here.
That's all right.
As you look at many news institutions around the country, they stopped chasing journalism and they started chasing clicks.
Clicks.
So if your story is based on the most amount of, if the success of your story is governed by the most amount of clicks you get, then you don't become a journalist, you become an influencer. And that's the word I was searching for before. And I think that that's the challenge in our news cycles now. If your story is evaluated by how many clicks or how many people respond to it, then often the angle is the most controversial part of the story. Life is nuanced. News is nuanced. Problems are complicated. And if you present your news just to get the most amount of response, often you lose the important facts of or the nuance that folks need to understand that particular issue.
So it's such an interesting point that Ron's making there, Andre, because the local news sources, especially formerly print news sources that are surviving, are increasingly going digital, are increasingly click-driven. I'm holding the most recent copy of the Banner in my hands, still in print, but I've read there has to be more digital strategy too. So how do you keep the true north of the way the Banner has told stories, the focus, and the, you know, if you go back and read 20 articles about people reflecting on this sale and transfer, and what they'll say about Mel Miller and the Banner over and over and again is they were committed to telling the truth, right? So how do you resist those forces that Ron was just talking about and come up with a distribution model, revenue model, et cetera, that keeps this local paper alive when so many have failed?
Well, I think... Excuse me. I think that, but our expansion into other markets, in other New England markets, will give a wider range of information for the general public. We're not just going to stick to Massachusetts. We're going to expand into other areas of New England because we know
Connecticut and Rhode Island,
and north of New England. You know, Mel won an award from the, and I think it was in 2019, from the Black Heritage Trail in New Hampshire, and that's a salient story that resonates not only in New Hampshire, but also in Boston and vice versa. You know, there's a rich history of the Underground Railroad in Vermont. And there are very large cities with people of color in Connecticut. Bridgeport, New Haven, and Hartford have large minority communities. And we want to have their stories told too, which may not happen without our initiatives.
And I also want to say that for our website, it's definitely going to get a different type of approach. We're going to turn it into an interactive online portal for the community. It will be an interactive online resource. So you'll be able to come there and not just read the news, but actually apply for opportunities, have educational experiences, connect you to job placement, different things like that. So we're going to take the current online platform and add a lot more options and a lot more interactivity so that it becomes a full resource for the community. So folks can go there and see sports games and see things like that that will be on the reserve listing within the menu. So if you missed your child's sports game, you might be able to see it there. It's just basically taking what Mel did, which was providing a service to the community and transferring it onto all the different ways people, and especially younger audiences, receive their news.
So Two free associations there. First, we had the new head of tourism, sports, and conventions, John Borders IV, on last week here on the show. And one of the things he talked about was how important things like high school sports games that you can actually watch, right? Not just in person, but broadcast, et cetera. Those small but really meaningful local moments are to keeping community. And I want to echo that in hearing what you just said, Ron. The other thing, Andre, that is on my mind here All right. So the full details of the purchase and the transaction haven't been reported and are not out in the news. But the banner itself talked about the fact that Orlando Watkins of the Boston Foundation and Glenn Lloyd of the Mill Cities Community Investment were instrumental in supporting the deal. And just for Mill Cities Community Investment is the first Black-led community development financial institution in Massachusetts. There's been real work behind the scenes in Greater Boston over the last 15 years to see junior leaders of color emerge into these senior leadership positions. And the hypothesis all along was you'd see different outcomes. You know, you get an Amari Paris Jeffries in, he starts to run the Embrace, and now you have the statue. So you've got Orlando, you've got Glenn. How much was a new ecosystem of Black leaders with power and resources partnering with you, who are the next generation of Black journalists, to making this whole thing happen? Do you understand my question?
Without question, it was priceless, you know, because the environment has changed from an economic standpoint, and there's a lot more support for CDFIs, community development institutions that support Black businesses. Glenn Lloyd, you know, we work with Glenn for over a year on this project, to be candid. I'm a very good friend of Glenn's. I've known him for decades. I met him when he was in high school as a tennis player, you know, and he's always been a New England guy.
Ran
and
City
to watch
Fresh
his
Foods.
Ascension through the Eastern Bank development and then into a separate entity, it's definitely crucial. And I think it bodes well for our community of business leaders in Boston and the opportunity. I know, you know, if you look at the new Parcel 3 bid, with the young ladies who run Onyx, who were able to put that deal together.
Over across from the Boston
Police
Department.
That's right.
And that's been a 30-year, you know, quest to get Parcel 3 developed. And here we have a female, Black female, or minority-led female company developing that piece of property. So there's great opportunities in Massachusetts for companies when you partner with these other organizations that have come out of the groundswell of support for female-led and, you know, minority-led businesses. So, as I said, Andre and I worked on this, you know, over a year and a half to make it happen, and I think we were the right people at the right time. You know, Mel had turned down multiple other deals, and it wasn't about money. It was about who they were or what he thought they might bring to his paper, to his legacy. So we were honored to be the folks who were able to finally make a deal with him. And we also have to thank, because there was a lot of private investors, a lot of, you know, prominent African-American folks from the greater Boston area, who invested in our company, Mitchell Stark Enterprises, to allow us to be able to do that. So it was a three-tier system.
So last question then. So now Andre Stark.
I just want to interject. You know, Ron is right. And we had a lot of prominent Black Bostonians invest in us. And a lot of times people don't really discuss those issues. They don't know about Black Bostonians being prominent or being entrepreneurs or being invested in their community. They just don't hear it. And that's part of what we're going to be doing, explaining those issues going forward. But we did, as Ron just mentioned, had a lot of Black investors from the community.
Let's illustrate that. So now, Andre, you are one of the co-owners of the Bay State Banner. What's the story you can't wait to tell?
I can't wait to tell about how Black joy is emanating from the city. There's a lot of great organizations that have fallen through the cracks through the media and other organizations that just don't get a lot of ink. I'll give you one, the Center for Teen Empowerment that I'm involved with. And to be clear, they do a lot of leadership programs. State Senator Liz Miranda has gone through the program. Everett City Councilor Gurley Adrian has gone through the program. So has Crystal Haynes of Channel 25. But you don't hear about those stories, do you? Not very often. And those are the kind of stories that we're going to take and touch on. And, you know, we have to realize that the ethos for this paper is going to be reporting and supporting the members of this community.
And how about you, Ron? What's a story you can't wait to tell as a new co-owner?
I can't wait to tell the story about the Museum of the Museum of African American History. It's the Museum of the National Center. I'm going to say it correct. The Museum of the National Center of African American History, which is going through a revitalization right now. And I can't wait to tell the story of that museum's history, Barry Gaither, who ran it for so many years, to help bring attention to it so that it definitely gets the corporate support it needs to finalize its appropriate development and continue being a great art institution for our city. Boston is an amazing art city, and we can't afford to lose or divest in any of our art institutions, especially our African-American artist institutions. So that would be one of the stories that I'm looking forward to telling.
All right, last couple questions here. And again, we're speaking with Ron Mitchell and Andre Stark, who are the new co-owners of the Bay State Banner, sold after 57 years by Mel Miller, and many were watching to make sure that this was a paper that would continue in some form when so many other local newspapers didn't. Andre, what's going to be the hardest part of it?
I think the hardest part of it is trying to tell all the stories in that we have saved up. You know, there's a lot of material that's going there, and we're getting calls from people right now that are going, hey, you know, I've got a great story. I've got this story, and it's going to be hard to sift through all of those. But we know that there's a lot of them, and especially there's a lot of them in those other communities that we talked about. There's a lot going on in Providence. There's a lot going on in New Haven and Manchester, New Hampshire. So it's going to be tough trying to encapsulate all of those issues and stories that we have, because each state has a slightly different situation. But here's a perfect example of another story we want to talk about. I forgot her name, but the woman who won the Oscar for costume design is from Springfield. Ruth, I just forgot her last name.
Yeah, and she was wearing this fabulous yellow dress at the event last night and talking about all the Ruth Carter, all the costume designers who had come before her, et cetera.
And that's right.
And she is the first African American woman to win two Oscars. Period.
Period.
Period. The first African-American woman.
And grew up here.
That's right.
Yes. Yeah. And a little sneak peek in our episode this week, we'll have a column by Tanya Hart, who was there on the red carpet for the awards. So we're also going to, you know, bring in those national stories and expand the storytelling. Tanya does have roots to Boston, but again, you know, this is some of the thing we're going to bring to the paper, as well as bringing sports and, you know, multiple other departments that over time have been shrunken or diminished, or that Mel didn't necessarily feel was as crucial.
Well, but we will be watching and reading. Ron Mitchell is one of the co-owners, the new co-owners of the Bay State Banner. Andre Stark, the other, both here with us in Studio 2. Really important time in local news. Good luck.
Thank you so
Thank
much.
You very much.
Great to have you.
Thank
nice
you for
to
having
be here.
Us.
The Northeastern women's hockey team is on a tear. We last spoke with them early February, right before the regionally vital Beanpot Final, which they won.
4 seconds remain, and the Northeastern Huskies will claim the 44th annual Women's Beanpot Championship.
Fast forward to the first week of March, they win their sixth Hockey East title in a row.
Northeastern has done it again, six straight Batania trophies as Hockey East champions in women's hockey.
And now they're in the NCAA National Tournament. They just beat Yale 4-1 on Saturday to secure their third consecutive trip to the Frozen Four in Duluth, Minnesota. For the uninitiated, that is the semifinal in the tournament. With us before they head to Duluth is Associate Head Coach Nick Carpenito. Nick, welcome back.
How are you, Tiziana? Thanks for having me.
Feeling good?
Feeling good. Feeling good. It was a fun weekend, and I thought the team prepared well. They executed well, and we were fortunate enough to be able to come up on over a really good Yale team.
Okay, so Nick, that is lovely, but also very muted. Take us to the ice right after they beat Yale on Saturday, and you realize you're going to the Frozen Four.
Yeah. I mean, we're fortunate. We've been there the last couple of years too. So, it's exciting. I don't think a lot of people out there outside of our organization really gave us much of a chance in that game. So it was a really quality statement game for us against a team that was ranked number two in the country for a pretty good amount of the year.
None of the young women players could join us because of classes, and good on them for being in classes today. But tell us what you're hearing from them right now as they get ready.
Yeah, I mean, they're very excited. Fortunately, we've got some very, very reasonable professors at our school that's going to let them miss a little bit more time. But I think it's for a really good cause, obviously. And, they're hungry. They're ready. We've been in this situation the last couple of years. We haven't been able to get over the hump. So You know, they feel like this is our year to hopefully make some noise in the Frozen Four.
I do want to talk about that situation the last couple of years, because that doesn't do it justice. So the last couple of years in the Frozen Four, in 2021, losing in the finals in overtime, and then last year losing in the semifinals in double overtime. Those are blows, especially for young athletes. So how do you help the team get over the psychological hump of those two heartbreaks going in this time?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the biggest differences between the last couple of years and this year is we have a pretty big roster turnover. You know, the previous 2 years, there was a difference of two players between both teams. You know, so this year we graduated 12 players last year. So, you know, our older players, we're going to, you know, obviously heavily rely on them to kind of guide our younger players. But, you know, those younger players have a bit of a fresh perspective on it. So hopefully they don't have necessarily that in the back of their mind. We just want them to enjoy the experience and, you know, do what this current team has done all year. And, you know, let's execute and make sure we're as prepared as possible.
We're talking with Nick Carpenito, who's associate head coach of Northeastern University's women's ice hockey team, which is going to the Frozen Four starting this weekend. I am taken aback. Okay, so in professional sports, if you found out that you had a team that had made it to the semifinals or the finals a couple years in a row, and 12 of the core team members had moved on to someplace else, you would not expect to see that team go again. You'd expect a couple of years of rebuilding. And yet I was reading an article about your game against Yale over the weekend. One of your clutch players was a freshman. So how are you pulling it off with such replacement? I mean, is it the recruiting? Is it the coaching? And I understand I'm asking one of the coaches the question, but that is not typically what you'd expect.
Well, obviously, it was all the coaching, you know. No, I'm just kidding. it's our leadership, you know. It's the core group that we have in place that's brought along the new players. And you know, as coaches, obviously we have our expectations for the team, but you know, it's the leadership and the captain group that implements those expectations more than anybody, because we're with our players maybe 3-4 hours, 6 days a week, you know, and it's the leadership that's with our players in the locker room. They're with their players on campus. Some of them are roommates with one another. So, you know, it's a huge testament to our older players, our veteran players that are bringing along our younger players to help us get where we're at today.
So I can't hear you say that and not think about the reporting that's been going on about the toxic culture inside the Harvard women's ice hockey team. So what is the difference between an unhealthy culture and a healthy culture for women college athletes? What is, in your mind, core to a healthy culture for women college athletes?
Yeah, I mean, I can't comment much to what's going on over in Harvard, but you know, as far as our culture, which I think is a very strong one, honestly, the biggest determining factor is trust. And that's trust between players, that's trust between coaches and trust between coaches and players. You know, the trust that we're always going to do, everybody's always going to do the right thing at the rink and away from the rink. And, you know, for our coaches, one of our biggest philosophies is that we want to treat these student athletes not just as hockey players, but as people, you know, because there's so much more that goes into it. It's not professional hockey. There's a couple taking online classes, but there's no Boston Bruins that's taking a full class load during the day and then, you know, having to go through practice and then a pretty rigorous game schedule throughout the course of the season. So, you know, it's a bit different of a dynamic. And, you know, these student athletes, they're not just athletes, they're also students. So, you know, keeping in mind that there's a lot more going on than just what's going on the ice. There's a lot that goes on away from the ring, keeping that in mind and, you know, making sure that we have respect for these young women, that, you know, it's not always going to be perfect, and making sure that they know that just as much as we know that.
So, Nick, before we let you go, I do want to call out, you do have some thumping good players on the team. I want to point out 10 finalists for the 2023 Patty Kazmaier Memorial Award. They were announced on March 2nd. It's given to the top player in the NCAA Division I women's hockey. Three of the top 10 were Northeastern University players, Maureen Murphy, Gwyneth Phillips, and Alina Mueller. And Alina Mueller has made the top three. That's something, the top 10, and you had three of them. Who are you excited? I'm sure you're excited to see them all play, but give us a couple people to watch in the tournament starting this weekend.
From our team or just in general?
From your team. Let's be homers about this.
Yeah. I appreciate that. obviously, Alina, number 11, incredibly gifted player from Switzerland. She's actually a three-time Olympian and scored the game-winning goal in the bronze medal game when she was 14 years old, which is pretty incredible.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Our whole top line of Alina, Chloe Arar from France, and Maureen Murphy, they're probably the best line in college hockey, I would say, at this point. All three 200-point scorers, Alina being a 250-point scorer. Megan Carter, she's one of our defensemen. She played she had her first cap with the Canadian national team this past year. So we're very excited about her. And then obviously Gwyneth Phillips, she's the backbone of our defense as the goaltender. And I think she's in the running and has a pretty good shot at that Goaltender of the Year award this year.
All right. Well, the 2023 Women's Frozen Four begins on Friday the 17th at Amsoil Arena in Duluth, Minnesota. The national championship is Sunday, March 19th. When do you head out, Nick?
We'll be heading out Wednesday.
All right. We wish you good luck in the tourney. Nick Carpenito is associate head coach of the Northeastern women's ice hockey team. Nick, good luck and thanks.
Thank you so much.
You give that guy a look like that, and that's what happens. Kiss every single time.
Kiss everyone goodbye.
Kiss him goodbye. That sound from NBC Sports Boston as a clutch Jason Tatum three-pointer helped seal a Celtics win against the Atlanta Hawks over the weekend. He and the rest of the team look to be on the mend from a bit of a post-All-Star game slump and a lot going on in the world of professional men's sports in Boston. So we're going to round it all up, and we're going to start with the Celtics. Joining us here in Studio 2, Abby Chin, who is the Celtics reporter for NBC Sports Boston. Welcome back, Abby.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Also on the line, Jonathan Marshall, sports reporter for WMUR. Welcome back, Jonathan.
Good to be here. How's it going?
It's going great, thanks. And seems to be going a little bit better for the Celtics. Abby, I'll start with you. What did you see on Saturday night, and how did it compare to what we've been seeing since the All-Star break?
Well, I think there was certainly some adversity that the Celtics had faced, more so than they had at any point in this season after the way the season started and everything that they went through with the Ime Udoka situation. And it was just something that we haven't necessarily seen from them before, where they were letting double-digit leads slip and not being able to fight back, maintain their composure, and get wins. And so it was very nice to see that in Atlanta, despite the Marcus Smart ejection, which we can get into if you like. But they were able to come together, withstand the run by the Hawks, and come out with a win. And that's the team that we have seen all season long. And it was just very, I think, reassuring to see them be able to get back to that.
So I think most of our listeners know now about the Ime Udoka situation. But just for those who may not, again, that is the coach who was suspended from the Boston Celtics. And then going into the All-Star break weekend, the Celtics made interim head coach Joe Mazzulla permanent, meaning Udoka is no longer with the organization. And before I go to Jonathan, Abby, you talked about the ejection from the game for Marcus Smart, so you may as well tell us what happened there.
Marcus got into a little tussle, I would say, with Atlanta star Trae Young, and it was Young who eventually got, I feel like they were wrestled to the ground. The post-game pool report from the head referee said it felt like it was not a natural act and that Marcus Smart tossed him to the ground. Watching the game live and even in the replays, it didn't feel like that for me.
And that's important because Marcus Smart was ejected, but the other player was not.
He was not. He was assessed a technical for pointing at Marcus afterwards, after they both got up. And so we have not heard from Marcus yet. He left the locker room immediately after the game, and there is no shoot-around today in Houston. So we'll see. It's Marcus Smart, as we know, is the heart and soul of the Celtics. He is the emotional spark for this team. And he has been really good about keeping those emotions in check, being able to toe the line to where he needs to. And he also knows how important he is to this team. So I'm sure he was disappointed in the decision. And I still question whether it was worthy of an ejection.
So, Jonathan, I'll turn to you here because we've talked a number of times this year as we've watched the Celtics along with the other teams about maturity, seasoning, right? And everything Abby just said makes me want to turn back to you and say, okay, at this point in the Celtics season, what are we seeing on the maturity and seasoning front from this team?
Yeah, I mean, we've mentioned before, it's a long season, right? You're going to have your lows, your ups and downs, and it's how do you play through that, right? Whether it's injuries, whether it's a couple losses here in a row, right? And so I think at this point, the Celtics, it's all about the playoffs and how do they attack that? And these are young group of guys age-wise, but they have experience, right? And so I think right now it's all about the playoffs. How do they combat, you know, last year's experience in the finals? How do they use that to their advantage this season? So I'm really, really looking forward to how they come back a year later and get ready mentally for another long playoff stretch, because it's a long stretch, right? And so it'd be interesting to see how they handle that this year. But last year's experience will do wonders for them. So I don't question mentally where they'll be at.
And Jonathan, there's no one who seriously thinks the Celtics are not going to make the playoffs, correct?
Oh, no, they're in.
Yeah, I think it's almost mathematically impossible.
So are we at that point?
We're getting there. We're not there. I know the Bruins clinched their spot.
I was going to say, because the reporting is that the Bruins technically mathematically did it. But Abby, you're saying...
We have not reached that point, but I think it would be very difficult for them to fall out.
They'd have to, like, really work at
it. Especially with the play-in game and everything. Yes, it would have to go off of a cliff, and even then, I'm not sure it's possible.
Okay, and Abby, coming back to you, Jonathan has also talked to us in the past about how important that number one seed is. It is interesting, given how strong a season they've had, that they're not in it right now. Milwaukee Bucks are holding that top spot in the East. So what do they have to do to go in as the number one seed?
Ugh, Giannis and the Bucks just won't lose. Not enough. Anyway, yes, the Celtics have been the steady juggernaut all season long. And as Jonathan alluded to, the driving force has been that loss in the NBA Finals a year ago. And that is something that emotionally, both of the stars, Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown, have talked about extensively, just how much that hurt, how awful the summer was and how hard they have worked. Everything that they are doing did over the summer, every step that they're taking this season is in preparation to get back to the NBA Finals and get over the hump. And so I agree with Jonathan completely. It is all about the Celtics preparing for the playoffs. And the key factor here is going to be health for this team. Mm-hmm. And yes, that number one seed is really important, because if you're going to go up against the Bucks once again in the Eastern Conference Finals, you want to be at home in TD Garden for a possible Game 7. But I still have confidence in this team. And we've seen it for years with LeBron James. It doesn't necessarily matter where your seeding is, as long as your team is playing their best basketball going into the postseason.
All right. So, Abby, I'm going to have you stay with us, but we're going to turn to the Bruins for a minute. And I'm going to bring another voice in here. Chris Siderick is the former host of WBZ's Upfront with Chris Siderick, and former senior producer here at Radio Boston, has been doing sports roundups with Jonathan and me throughout the season. Chris, welcome back.
You just can't get rid of me.
What's up, Chris?
What's going on, John?
So, Chris, we are in our continuing saga over learning to love the Boston Bruins and seeing them kind of be freakish on the ice. Now, they did drop two of their last three. So where are we?
Yeah, they dropped two of their last three, and I would say that they've shown some kind of concerning signs about starting slowly, which has been a problem for this team in past years. And it's bled into the playoffs at times. So I've seen a couple of things that are cause for concern there. They had a home-and-home against the Detroit Red Wings this weekend, which means home in Boston and then home at Detroit for the Red Wings. And they split that series. But in both of those games, they fall behind 2-0 in the first period, which is obviously not a great way to start. Now, you know, Saturday, they come back and win that game. And even yesterday, they end up down 4-0 and end up making it a 4-3 game for ultimately losing 5-3. But so they're never out of a game, which is a good thing. But these sluggish starts, I think, have been pretty problematic.
And Jonathan, we've talked about the fatigue factor. I mean, it's a brutal game. It's, you know, I will say it's a long season, although there, you know, I'll hear other people, baseball is longer, but it's long enough when you're playing ice hockey. And are you worried about fatigue and injury? We've talked before about the worry that they're just going to peak too soon.
I mean, you have to be, right? Injuries, especially when, you know, when it comes to such a sport such as hockey, especially, right? But I just want Boston sports fans to embrace what you guys are seeing right now. Like the records, yes, that this team is making. I know you guys want excellence. You expect excellence. What you're seeing is excellence right now, you know? So just embrace what this team is doing. They've already clinched.
Jonathan, you're missing the championship or bust approach that we have.
No, but that's
Boston,
I was going to say that too. Aren't you nitpicking? We're talking about slow starts with the team that has the best record in the NHL.
Well, fastest team ever to 50 points, yes, too, which is impressive in its own right, for sure.
Okay. You're not entertained, Chris. Yeah.
But Chris, I do want you to bring in a sampling for us of what happened in the loss with the Red Wings, because, well, A, we have to have some drama with the Bruins. We can't just assume it's straight. And B, it does illustrate the challenges of even an excellent team.
Yeah, and I think really what it's going to come down to for this team is focus. Can they play up to their level of talent? Because they are just such a talented team, such a deep team. We've talked about it throughout the season. But you saw a little bit of both the good and the bad of David Pastrnak, one of the greatest players in the league. He is second in the league in goals scored this season, but he's also first in the league in giveaways, in turnovers of the puck, basically. And that reared its ugly head again yesterday.
Orlov, the new guy on the top unit, taking McAvoy's spot as he dishes off for Pastrnak. And this is stolen away by Seider. Mo Seider, shorthanded. The backhand, he scores! A shorthanded goal for Mo Seider gives the Boston Bruins a two-goal deficit to deal with here in Detroit.
And I want to note, Chris, that sound from TNT. So we do know nobody's invincible. So what do we start watching for now in this? I mean, I could imagine, Chris, that the Bruins' mental intensity, given the fatigue and the fact that they know they're a lock in the playoffs, normal human beings would have a little drop off in mental intensity.
Right. And what's scary about that is there is maybe nothing more intense in all of sports than hockey playoffs. Mm-hmm. The speed and the level of physical contact is just off the charts. And they're going to have to bring it day in and day out to make a deep playoff run. You asked about keys, things to watch for. I think the biggest thing to watch for this team is special teams, which basically means I think they're fine in the 5-on-5 hockey. But both on the power play, when they have an extra player on the ice, and on the penalty kill, when they are shorthanded, we've seen some signs of weakness in the last, you know, 10 or 15 games here. So we want to see them scoring goals on the power play. And as you just heard in that clip, not giving up shorthanded goals. When you've got an extra guy on the ice, there's no excuse for giving up breakaway goals to the opponent. So watch those special teams moments and see if they can start generating some goals on the power play. We've seen the Dmitry Orlov has been added to that power play unit, which hopefully is starting to help them find a little bit of a rhythm, but they still need to increase the shots. So they should be more aggressive on the power play, and you want to see the penalty kill, which has been great all season, had a couple of blips this weekend. Let's see if they can get that back on track.
So Jonathan Marshall, literally explain what special teams are, because they come up in football, they come up in ice hockey. Abby, do they come up in?
No.
I didn't think so. So Jonathan, tell us what a special teams is.
Yeah, special teams is this the auxiliary part of the game, right? That we really don't, you know, give credit to, but they really are crucial, right? It's those little things that, like in football, a field goal, right? Those 3 points will come in handy. That's what we're talking about when it comes to special teams.
And I would say key players in very specific situations. So football is different than hockey in that football, you know, there's a kicking game, the return game, the punt game. In hockey, it's the penalty kill. Right, Chris? And it's very specific game situations where you have specific players who go in and are adept in those situations.
We're speaking with Abby Chin, Jonathan Marshall, Chris Sidorek. We are stretching our legs across all the men's professional sports teams here in Boston. One last question on the Bruins. We've covered the Celtics. We're doing the Bruins now. One last question here. It continues, and I may be the only human being in the world that this is interesting to, but I don't think I am. We've got these two young coaches in Jim Montgomery and Joe Mazzulla for the Bruins and the Celtics, mm-hmm, respectively. And now, high stakes sports with the potential to bring home a trophy for both teams. And I'm asking all three of you, are these two coaches ready for the moments they're finding themselves in? Abby, I'm looking at you, okay, so you go first.
I was going to say, I can only speak to Joe Mazzulla. And from everything that we've seen from him so far, I say yes. But as you're saying, we have not seen him in these high leverage situations in the playoffs. There is a reason, though, that Brad Stevens tapped Joe immediately when everything went down. By the way, 3 days before training camp was set to start. And so there's no question the Celtics see something in him. And in that press conference where they announced that Joe was no longer under the interim tag, Brad Stevens talked about just how well Joe has been able to rally the group under together towards one mission. And we've seen that all season long. The questions to me will come in those game, in-game adjustments, making in-series adjustments once we get to the playoffs, and then going up against future Hall of Famers if they have to face the Heat and Eric Spoelstra and different matchups like that. So I think that will be, it's still to be found out.
And Brad Stevens, for listeners, former head coach, now in the front office. Just briefly, Chris, on Jim Montgomery and the Bruins.
Yeah, I'm much less worried about Jim Montgomery than Joe Mazzulla. And I'm not worried necessarily about Mazzulla. I think, as Abby just said, unproven. We'll see kind of how those in-series adjustments go. I think you saw from Montgomery yesterday, he's not afraid to tinker with the lineup and change who's on the ice with who to try to switch the momentum up. And it worked. They got it going in the second period precisely because Montgomery was making those adjustments, and it ended up going on a 3-goal run, almost tied that game back up. So I think Jim Montgomery absolutely can take this team where they need to go.
All right. So Jonathan Marshall, I want to move to the New England Patriots now. Big news on Friday that Devin McCourty announced his retirement. He was a standout player for the team through 13 seasons in the NFL. And he leaves a hole not only as a great player in his position, but in the culture of the team. We want to illustrate that. There's a little sound courtesy of the Patriots. Sidelines 2021 pregame.
We don't need no hype or none of that tonight, fellas. Yeah. Feel this moment. Let's leave a legacy for this game. When you was 5 years old telling people you dreamed of being in the NFL. Yeah. You didn't think you'd be here? I don't care what happened yesterday, last week, none of that. Show up today. If you want to be champions, whoever's on that other side, we got to destroy it, fellas. Yeah, and while we destroy, we got to dominate, fellas. Yeah, yeah. Dominate on three. One, two, three.
Dominate. I want to suit up. Just
let's go.
I love it.
So, Jonathan, how big a hole does Devin McCourty leave? I mean, this is a team that feels to a fan like they've lost their heart a little already. And then yeah, Devin McCourty, wow.
Yeah, it's huge. I mean, he's been a part of the organization for how long, right? He's been a part of multiple Super Bowl championships. So, once again, another player from that era who's won championships is no longer in that locker room. So it's crucial to have that presence, that voice in that locker room. That's a part of sports that can't be overlooked. So it's going to be a huge void for sure.
Chris Siderick, I feel like I know Devin McCourty from not as much on television, but all the nonprofit organization events and the charity events and the fundraisers, et cetera. We've seen this before. We lose an athlete who belongs to a team, but who has brought a heart to the city as well. Talk about that a little bit with Devin McCourty.
Yeah, I'm so glad you mentioned it, Tiziana. I was going to say we'd be remiss to not mention all of the work he's done off the field. He's been so eloquent and outspoken about criminal justice reform and real social issues and has pushed for meaningful change on a lot of fronts. And I think it just speaks to him as a leader. Basically, he was a born leader in all aspects of his life, and he played that role for this team. He played that role for this city, and he's going to be missed, definitely.
So, Abby, I'll turn to you because you're reporting on the Celtics, who are sort of star ascending, or star has ascended and star is staying ascended, right? And here we have what we've been watching with the New England Patriots. Just a couple of very tough seasons, a lot of questioning of the coaching team, et cetera. In this offseason, what is most important to see the Pats do in your mind?
I think they've done a lot of it, and that is going back to Bill O'Brien as the offensive coordinator, bringing in a recognizable name who you believe in that position. I think there were so many question marks, like you said, about the coaching staff and everything that was going on around Mac Jones. And I think solidifying that is a huge sign of relief. But then you also do want to see them. I mean, they are top 10 in the NFL with salary cap space. So not that you want to see them what they did a couple of years ago where they just went on a spending spree and clearly not everything worked, as I'm sure you're going to mention the trade of Jonnu Smith. But you do want to see investments being made on both sides of the ball, but particularly, I would say, on the offensive end.
So, yes, for me, it's always coaching, coaching, coaching. Yep. But the players actually matter. And Jonathan Marshall, Abby just, you know, hinted at it. The Patriots traded tight end Jonnu Smith to the Falcons for a seventh-round draft pick, per reporting from NFL.com. The free agency window in the NFL starts at noon this day. What kinds of moves do you anticipate need to be made, et cetera?
Abby was on point. I mean, offensively, I mean, it's no secret that it leaves a lot to be desired, right? You love Rhamondre Stevenson. He's a nice young running back on the rise. We love that. But I don't think we know what to make of Mac Jones. I don't know if he's been given a fair shot coaching-wise.
Quarterback
and talent-wise. Mm-hmm. Yeah, quarterback Mac Jones and talent-wise around him, right? And so when it comes to the NFL, you got to give your young quarterbacks especially a chance to succeed. And I think at wideout, they have to make some improvements. Maybe getting, I mean, Jacoby Myers has been solid. Tyquan Thornton, you know, he was a rookie last year. He shows some promise, but maybe, shoring up that wide receiver group is number one on my list. I want to see them give Mac Jones a chance. Let's get some weapons in here.
Although, Jonathan, how many years have we been talking about the wide receiving core for the Patriots?
Wow, that's true.
Needing to
Going
beef
back
that
to
up.
Terry Glenn, probably.
That is true.
How many decades have we been talking about?
Man.
Chris, well, Jonathan mentions Jacoby Myers there, who's a free agent and not necessarily going to be back with this team. He was definitely Mac Jones' security blanket, I think, of that entire core. And I would say Jonnu Smith, who they just traded, maybe the most physically explosive weapon they had on offense. So I think they absolutely need to shore some of that up. And they've got to make sure that they solidify the offensive line as well, protect Mac